drug formulations, protein folding, growing perfect crystals. All of those are possible in microgravity. They're not possible here on Earth. So when people ask me what keeps you up at night, it's not the normal answers. It's exactly that. You know, we play a lot of small ball. Like, the world is based upon small ball and squabbles and things that just aren't important.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. None of it matters.
And you think space gives you that perspective?
I do.
This is the ProCo 360 podcast for people who love Colorado and love hearing from Colorado's most inventive and successful entrepreneurs. Today's guest has launched companies, challenged the status quo of space exploration, and even orbited the Earth himself. Dylan Taylor is CEO of Voyager Space, and he's leading an aerospace revolution from right here in Colorado. Voyager Space has funding from heavyweight investment firms and from NASA, and collaborates with giants in the industry, including Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. Dylan Taylor, welcome to ProCo 360.
Well, thank you. Great to be here.
I'm glad. You know, it's so exciting to have. I mean, there are some great Colorado space companies. Mm-hmm. Voyager Space is coming on and getting a huge reputation. So start, though, by explaining the problem that you were trying to solve as you created Voyager Space.
Well, I was running public companies most of my career in different industries. And so personally, I reached a point in my life where I was successful, in quotes, whatever that means, but not particularly satisfied, a bit miserable, to be honest, and kind of wrestling with, you know, what's the purpose of all this? What's my legacy? What's my impact on Colorado? What's my impact on the world? And in reflecting on that, I just harken back to, what am I passionate about? What do I really believe in? And for me, it had always been space. Maybe for not the reasons that you would expect. Like, a lot of people think space is cool. It's the next frontier, exploration, all that, which I love. But for me, it was really more the social element of it, which is, can we reimagine what humanity can be? Can we imagine treating ourselves better? And one of the phenomenon of people going to space, and I can vouch for this because I've been up there, is this notion of the overview effect, where you see the world differently. You have a cognitive shift because you see, in many respects, we're all in this together, right? There is no other place. There is no other people. There's only here and us. So that was really the thesis by which, if you believe that, then the next question is, how do we get more people out there? How do we build infrastructure in space to support, you know, this beachhead, if you will, this next frontier?
You know, that sounds really wonderful, but until you get a billion people in the space, can we all join hands and sing "We Are the World"? And, you know, like, how do you scale that feeling?
Well, it's a good question. I think you start with leadership. So one of my dreams, you know, Voyager's working on building the replacement to the International Space Station, right? That project's called Starlab. One of my dreams was, why couldn't we have a UN Security Council meeting on Starlab? You know, why couldn't we have a G7 meeting on Starlab? And I think we would get a different outcome. I know it sounds Pollyannish. I know it sounds, you know, idealistic.
Well, it's hard to relate to, because I have not shared the experience of being in space and feeling that sense of almost nirvana, I suppose, of what the world could be.
Right.
So do you believe, though, that if the global leaders that we're fighting, if Putin and Zelensky were on Starlab talking, that we'd have a different outcome?
Here's what I know. There's been about 650 people have been up there, and I've probably talked to a couple hundred of them, maybe 150. Rich, poor, government employees, private citizens, Asian, European, Muslim, atheist, Christian, fighter pilot, scientist, artist, male, female, old, young. And every single person I've talked to has been impacted by the experience.
Do you think that those people, I'm dwelling on this because it's fascinating to me, do you think that those people back on Earth would be less likely to fight, to have conflict, than the general population?
Yes. Yes. I mean, I think when you're up there, it's so obvious. It is so obvious that we have more in common than we think. And we squabble over things that are probably not as important as we think they are.
That's fascinating. Is that what motivates the idea that that you want to build essentially plug-and-play technology, things that are where different companies, even from different countries, could contribute to, whether it's Starlab or other Voyager space projects, that everybody should be able to have a piece and be compatible?
Yeah, I mean, that's an element of it. The main reason we are so collaborative on that is because space is so difficult. And you need the best and brightest, and you need skill sets from all over the world to actually pull it off. Because it's quite, you know, humans were not designed to live in space, right? It's
well, a we're also center. Not designed to be collaborative.
Well, I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure I agree with that. I think in smaller groups, we're designed to be collaborative.
Yeah.
Maybe scaling collaboration becomes difficult.
And you think experience in space can help us scale collaboration?
I do. And there's another philosophy that I subscribe to, which is, you know, part of conflict is about we don't have enough stuff, right? I need your stuff because I don't have enough stuff. And to me, that's a mind trap. I mean, if you look at successful people, and I'll talk about myself, to the degree I am successful, where it really accelerated for me was when I changed my mindset from scarcity to abundance. When I looked at the world as hey, we can create value as opposed to we're going to have a food fight over a fixed pie. That's when everything changed for me. And so I think as a species, humanity needs to collectively understand that. And one of the escape valves on resources is the fact that we have this eighth continent, if you will, which is the moon, right? Which has resources. Yeah. So I believe very strongly that mindset has a lot to do with our behavior. In fact, I'll take it a step further. As a leader of a large company and running public companies my whole career, one of the things I learned is if you don't like someone's behavior, look at the context by which you're putting them in. Look at the situation that they're bound by. And if you change those constraints, oftentimes the behavior will change.
Can you think of a specific example, just throwing it at you?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a highly political organization, it typically means that the leader in charge is susceptible to being influenced. And it's not a fact-based organization. So people are being political because that's the way you get things done.
Yeah. Now, you've mentioned your background a couple of times. And listeners, one of Dylan's big companies that he led was in commercial real estate. I can see why maybe you didn't find that as inspiring as space, right? But when you decided to get into space, I reflect too on, I had a conversation with Blake Scholl of Boom Supersonic, who knew nothing about supersonic flight and he taught himself everything, right? You thought you could bring something to the table in space that wasn't already there, right? Talk about that.
Well, I initially, when I had this epiphany, I'm like, I want to follow my true passion, which is space. I initially got involved as an investor. Not because I'm a great investor, not because I thought I had some special skill as an investor, but it was a way for me to learn the business plans, get to know the entrepreneurs, get plugged into the industry. I started writing a column regularly for Space News, and I was talking about industry dynamics and how the industry was likely to evolve. And a lot of the things I wrote about ended up coming to pass, and people were like, How did you know that was going to be the case? And because I had been in different industries, I could kind of had the pattern matching to be able to talk about where the industry was going. And so once I sort of focused on the early stage capital formation for the industry and largely solved that problem together with other people who contributed to that, I then thought to myself, well, what's next? What does the industry need next? And it really was struggling with scaling. So my thought was, and I admired companies like Danaher, if you're familiar with that, operating platforms that were really great at integrating acquisitions, integrating technologies, and building something spectacular. And I thought there's an opportunity to create an operating platform within the space industry. We purpose-built it to be a public company. Of course, we went public 2 weeks ago.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. And so that was on the roadmap from our founding. But the whole idea was, can you create an operating platform that can operate at scale, help the industry scale? And the whole reason back to the thesis was then you can do these large projects.
Well, and space, I think, until, of course, the new companies have come along, Blue Origin and SpaceX, and it was all NASA-driven, which was, you know, we must not fail in anything we do. And of course, there were a couple of epic failures, but for the most part, a very reliable, very slow-moving industry.
Right.
In fact, in my conversation with Tory Bruno a while back, at that time, and I still think it's true, United Launch Alliance, and I don't want to jinx it for them, has had zero failed launches.
Right.
So the idea that let's make everything perfect makes it slow.
Yeah.
How do you balance that? Especially like Apple specifically has kept its technology closed so that no one can screw it up. No one can plug stuff in that would mess it up. You're doing the exact opposite, right? So talk about like, how are you going to de-risk when you're letting everybody else play in your sandbox?
Right. Well, part of it is, I think, bringing innovation to bear. So one of the consequences of NASA, because it's a large bureaucracy, is they are very risk adverse. And by definition, technology advancement requires a degree of risk because you're trying something new, right? You're implementing new technology. So reusable rockets would have never happened at NASA, mm-hmm. right? It required Elon and SpaceX to tackle that problem. And by the way, it wouldn't happen with ULA either, frankly. I love Tori. He's a good friend, but they're part of kind of that legacy prime contractor, right? So it needed someone coming from outside the industry, looking at something uniquely crazy. Inspire. So that's one element. But back to your point, which is a really, really good one. A lot of people don't get this. Six Sigma, right? That's your tolerance for failure, right? You've got one sigma, two, three, mm-hmm, four. So mm-hmm. Six Sigma, which is 99.9999, the difference between Six Sigma design and Four Sigma design is something like 10x the cost.
Yeah.
It's 10x the cost. And NASA has been Six Sigma. Like, we're going to have no human failures, like no deaths ever. And if you look at any frontier, any endeavor that humans have, you know, whether it's the high seas or, you know, settling different parts of the world or exploring different parts of the world, or new technologies like aircraft, there are going to be risks that people take. And so having a Six Sigma mindset is not practical if you want to have advancement.
You know, when you say that, though, I think of my absolute maniacal frustration with how slowly we're introducing self-driving vehicles mm-hmm. because we can't stand the idea of a single failure.
Right.
It just drags progress to almost to a stop. But you're in space, like you can't, I don't know. How do you think about that?
There's going to be some failures and there's going to be some fatalities and there's going to be some mistakes, and that's okay, right? I mean, that's, how many people die on the road today with human
many
driving
more,
cars?
Many more. Right. But I think if somebody famous were to listen to your clip on this podcast and hear you sort of verbally shrug over the idea that there are going to be some deaths, some people would get really agitated. Mm-hmm. I don't. Because I think that's just the way of the world.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not that I want that. It's
of
just,
course.
it's a, you know, look, you can sit in a room made of lead and say you're in this safe room and you could get hit by a meteor, right? That's like a non-zero event. So nothing.
That's an 8 sigma.
nothing in life is risk-free.
Yeah.
Like nothing. And by the way, we're all on a one-way trip here. Yeah. Everyone's on a one-way trip. No one's getting out of this thing alive, as Jim Morrison said.
Yeah, yeah. Although you did get back from space, which is great. Now, I'm fascinated too by Starlab. Just talk a little bit about the concept of that. Most of us, I think, are somewhat familiar with the space station, mm-hmm. right? But Starlab's different. Talk about that.
Yeah, so the International Space Station was really a consortium between Japan, European Union, U.S., Canada, and Russia. And so it's modules that have been kind of hodgepodged together. I think it's one of the best things humans have ever done. Hmm. I think it deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. I think it's brought the world closer together. We've had a lot of research on the ISS.
It's been there decades, right?
Decades. Here we're 27th year of, I think, continuous human habitation. But it's aging, right? It has active leaks on it, and it's going to be deorbited in 2030. NASA's already awarded the contract to SpaceX to do that. So they are commercializing, like they did with the space shuttle. They mm-hmm. sunsetted that. They awarded launch to commercial companies, which gave birth to SpaceX and others. They're doing the same thing on destinations. Mm. So no longer will they own and operate their own space station. They're going to back commercial space stations and then be a customer to space stations. So Starlab is one of those efforts. What's unique about it is optimized for research. That's why the term Starlab really focused on the laboratory mm-hmm. component of it. And microgravity is a bit of a magical thing. Research in microgravity can't be reproduced here on Earth. So, for example, drug formulations, protein folding, growing perfect crystals, all of those are possible in microgravity. They're not possible here on Earth. So there's a lot of things you can do in microgravity that are truly revolutionary from a research standpoint.
So if they're researched at microgravity, I've always been curious about this, like why all these experiments in space? If they're researched in microgravity and you are the first person to manufacture something in space, right? So if they're researched in microgravity, do they have to be then made in microgravity, or are we learning lessons that we can apply on Earth?
The latter. You can. So, for example, these perfect crystals, what you do is you can then return those to Earth. And when you have a perfect crystal seed, you can actually grow a larger perfect crystal here on terra firma.
Wow.
Yeah. You can print human organ tissue. A meniscus was printed on the ISS. You can actually theoretically bring those back. Imagine stem cells calibrated to your exact DNA structure. Sending those stem cells up there, printing an organ, a liver, a meniscus, you name it, a retina, and having that perfect organelle come down to Earth and be implanted in your body, and no risk of rejection because it's your own cells.
Why can't that be done on Earth?
Because gravity is a convective force, and if you're 3D printing organ tissue, the organelle will not form prior to it collapsing under the weight of gravity.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
It is.
All right. We're going to come back and talk a lot more about all kinds of stuff I'm curious about. But first, I want to remind listeners, this is ProCo 360, named Best Colorado Business Podcast the last 5 years. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and this is the podcast for people who love Colorado and the stories of Colorado businesses and entrepreneurs. My guest today is Dylan Taylor, CEO of Voyager Space. Hey, I want to thank sponsors. Give me a minute here. First, I'm going to start with Via Technologies. Thanks for hosting ProCo 360 and all the help your team gives me around managing the website. Colorado Biz Magazine does a great job of featuring Colorado companies. And in this last issue, you'll see it announced that ProCo 360 was named Best Colorado Business Podcast for the 5th year in a row. Love those guys. Also, Denver Ventures. We partner to feature great Colorado companies. Hey, one more mention. I'm a CU Business School alum, so I'm happy that ProCo 360 is partnering with the Leeds Business School at CU Boulder to reach each other's audiences. On the Leeds Business Insights podcast, you'll get fresh insights from conversations with professors, alumni, and thought leaders who share lessons from their successes in Colorado and beyond. You can listen to Leeds Business Insights on your favorite platform. All right, let's talk, Dylan, about you've moved from the real estate world, which for some it's inspiring, for most it might not be. Here you are in a space industry where you have to have a culture of bold thinking, of entrepreneurship, of experimentation. So what do you do to accomplish those kinds of values and in the right balance with risk at Voyager Space?
I think it's the people you hire, Dave. I mean, the key thing, I know it sounds very oversimplified, but it really is the people you hire into the company. And so culturally, we are really, really focused on people who are can-do attitude, high innovation. Anyone who says, can't do that or haven't done it or that, we've always done it this way, any kind of mentality like that is not a good fit for Voyager because we're leaning into this idea of... So the way to think about Voyager is it's an innovation and technology platform disrupting space. Right? It's not a space company. It's a technology and innovation platform disrupting space.
Well, when you call it a platform, what's that mean?
The ability to do different things at scale. So if we were a antenna manufacturer, for example, that would be a space company, right? Mm-hmm. If that antenna company was doing a subsystem that went on a space station, you could call that an aerospace company, right? Because it's there's more added value to the particular widget that they were building. But if you ask someone who in the world can be the prime contractor and build a space station, there's probably, we were one of three winners, right? That NASA awarded, but there's probably, 10 companies in the world that could win a contract like that.
So you're like a space general contractor?
Prime contractors are the term they use,
yeah.
But the reason I don't like prime contractor is a lot of the legacy prime contractors have been cost plus, not particularly innovative. So there's this new term called neo prime, I don't even know what that means. But the idea is that you're prime capable, but you're denominated on entrepreneurialism, on innovation, on flexible, adaptable.
That sounds workable until you scale. How do you stay that way as you scale?
Yeah, well, it's a brilliant question. So when people ask me what keeps you up at night, it's not the normal answers. It's exactly that. It's like we're 650 employees today. This time next year, we'll probably be closer to 2,000 because we're scaling rapidly for Starlab and other programs. And it's exactly that question. How do you not become calcified? How do you not become bureaucratic? How do you not become political? How do you not become just like the people that you're looking to disrupt?
Yeah. And then the next one comes along.
That's right.
So it strikes me that if more of your employees could reach space, that could perhaps be a way to trickle down, you know, this mindset, this awe mindset.
I think that would go a long way. But I think also just the purpose of working on something that enables people to go to space is enough.
Do you?
Well, I think—
But you can say that, but you did it.
Yes, true. But I just look generationally, a lot of, you know, I'd say 2/3 of our employees are probably under 35. And under 30 in particular, the first question they ask is not who do you work for? It's what are you working on?
Hmm.
What are you working on? Right.
Because.
And if, by the way, if the answer is I don't know, or I don't care, or you know, I build cars or something. It's got to have a purpose behind it. It's got to have a why behind it.
What do you want your employees to say if someone were to ask them that?
We're enabling humans to live and work in space.
Okay. Now, you seem to have, because I've heard a couple of your interviews and read some of your quotes, like this whole different view of space compared to, I think, what most of us think of. It's like a humanity thing, right? So what is your view of space and the opportunity that it provides?
Well, I think it's a blank canvas. I think it's a way for us to imagine what humanity could be. And I think, you know, I go back to, I know it sounds, you know, trite, but I go back to the Star Trek inspiration that I had as a young kid. You know, I was growing up at the time, my father was serving in Vietnam. I had a single mother. She was 20 years old. We were living pretty rough next to a group of Hell's Angels was our next door neighbor. And I remember watching Star Trek. It was, you know, on this old, you know, barely color TV, and comparing that to the world I was living in. And of course, the Star Trek realm, for those of you who don't know, they have things like a replicator. You go up, you order whatever you want, and it magically appears. The entire officer deck was diverse. You had people from all different backgrounds. Everyone was getting along. By the way, every week it was a new planet, so it was a new adventure. And I thought to myself, and it was very much post-scarcity, right? There was enough of everything. And I remember thinking to myself, why can't we live like that? Like, why can't humans work in such a way that we enable that future for ourselves? And I realize that's aspirational.
Well, yeah.
But it's something to... I'm a big believer in leadership of having a lighthouse. It doesn't, you don't tell people how to tack the boat and what the weather report is. You just say, look, that's where we're aiming. That's the lighthouse. You guys figure it out. I'm going to give you a lot of latitude. But I think space is one of those things where we can reimagine and have a more hopeful future. Mm-hmm. And I think that's inspiring. And by the way, I think one thing that everyone can agree on, I don't care what your political persuasion is or your religious background or whatever, is the world needs more inspiration.
Oh, for sure.
And space is one of those things that I think for a lot of people, especially young people, it's inspirational.
I think we'd all agree on that. Thinking back on Star Trek, I did want to talk to you about Star Trek because when you think about it, and yes, I loved how harmonious the deck was and how diverse it was. They still had the Klingons banging on their door from time to time, right? So it wasn't all peace.
True. Yeah. And that the Romulans were even worse because the Romulans, at least the Klingons, you could understand their mentality. The Romulans were just evil.
And
by the way, that exists in the world. I want to be clear on that. But what I'm talking about is of the people who are inclined to want a better future, using space as a lighthouse to reimagine the possibility, I think it's a healthy mental exercise. And so I believe in the ability of space to transform people's thinking. And, you know, we play a lot of small ball. Like the world is based upon small ball and squabbles and things that just aren't important.
Yeah.
You know, someone flames you on Twitter or X or something, and that's like the biggest deal in your life. And it's like, it doesn't matter. None of it matters.
And you think space gives you that perspective?
I do.
That's super cool. All right. One more question about Star Trek. So I was curious, what do you think they got right in Star Trek that many, what is it, 50 years ago or something?
Yeah, I think they got right this notion that if you take away scarcity, if you take away this notion of there's not enough stuff, that you get different behaviors. And I think it, you know, that's why I call it post-scarcity, right? And now it doesn't mean that you shouldn't, this is where they got it right. So what's the escape valve for humanity? If you're not competing over stuff, what are you competing over? You're competing over scientific knowledge. You're competing over what's over the hill. You're competing over discovery, right? So you're basically taking all that angst that we have where we're hitting each other over the head for a bushel of corn, and we're saying, let's collaborate and let's go discover what's over the hill. Let's discover, you know, what humanity could be. I think they got that right.
That's a very interesting perspective on scarcity. You think the world is more hopeful in general without scarcity?
I do. I mean, just look at your own life when you had more resources. When you crossed that, you know, you shared with me, Dave, you're a competitive person. I'm a very competitive person. That typically is born out of some kind of scarcity, you know, whether it's in your upbringing or in your mentality or something. Mm-hmm. Something happened in your life where there wasn't not enough stuff. And so you were out there, you know, trying to accumulate, trying to achieve, try to win, try to compete. Mm-hmm. You reach a point in your life where you have enough and you relax a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. I certainly did.
Wow.
And so I think a lot of it has to do with that.
Yeah. Well, you're getting a little philosophical, so it's a good note to change tone a little bit on, because you've got it, your own website, dylantaylor.org, mm-hmm. and you've got a lot of quotes on it. A lot of them. And rather than reading several, what's one of your favorites and why?
What is one of my favorites? I mean, I think, I don't know exactly how I would put this, but I think this whole notion that you control your state of mind, you control your current situation. People spend a lot of time talking about what's happened to them or what people are doing to them, but the way you react to your environment or to the way you've been treated or to your circumstance has everything to do with your level of satisfaction with your life. And so you control that. So one thing I said recently to someone I was mentoring, they were talking about someone hurting them. And I said, no, you allowed them to hurt you. And they said, I don't understand that. I said, because the whole notion of hurt is you had a certain expectation that you imputed on that person that they, you know, let you down on. And so you control the expectation. Yeah. If you don't want to be frustrated, you want to be disappointed, lower your expectation. It's like, well, that's not a great message. And I'm like, it's life.
Yeah,
it's life.
Yeah.
And so if you don't like the way you feel, and if you don't like the way your life is going, look at your mindset, because the mindset is everything.
You talk with your daughters about that?
I do. I mean, they've got their own opinions on the world at this point. So, you know, they're coachable within a range.
Yeah, I get that. All right. So you talked earlier, the very beginning of our conversation, about being in Colorado. Colorado, as most of our listeners know, is becoming more recognized as a space state, but it's awesome that you're here. What's your take on Colorado as a home for Voyager Space?
Oh, it's perfect. I mean, I love it here. I was actually born in Denver, even though I didn't grow up in Colorado. So we made it back here, my wife and I, from Chicago for lifestyle reasons. We love it. I would never leave. I could live anywhere in the world and I choose to live here. And we choose to base the company here. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is, as you alluded to, it's a great aerospace state. You've got the Air Force Academy. You've got a lot of great companies based here. People want to live here. So it's an easy state to recruit to. Is it business friendly? You know, it was probably more business friendly 10 years ago than it is today, but I think it's still on a relative basis pretty business friendly. And of course, you've got the outdoors. You know, we're talking right after the 4th of July break. We were up at our place in Granby this weekend, and I was just thinking to myself, where else in the world could you be? and you know, have this just wonderful lifestyle that we have. So we're very lucky. Coloradans are very lucky. All that being said, don't tell anybody that.
Yeah, I know.
When I talk to people from New York and elsewhere and they ask me about Colorado, I'm like, yeah, it's fine. Stay away.
But, you know, it has gotten to a point where there are enough aerospace companies here that, you know, it's not considered a terminal destination anymore.
No.
That, you know, if you want to move from one company to another, not that they want to, but if, you know, there's enough jobs that people can feel like there's an ecosystem.
For sure. Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. I think we crossed that threshold quite some time ago, and I think it's accelerating.
Now, I got a few just absolute curiosity questions that I wanted to ask you that listeners, they're not really in any logical sequence. Mm-hmm. Okay. Things I've been curious about. Do we need to simulate gravity in space for long-term living?
Yes.
Like you do?
Yes.
How does that work?
You can create basically a spinning cylinder and essentially create artificial gravity that way. So if you think about the classic amusement ride where you're spinning and you're pinned against the wall, you can do mechanisms that way. The other way to solve it, Dave, is you could hack your biology somehow and allow humans to live in microgravity. But I think that's a longer putt than artificial gravity.
Wow. Okay. What is the most unexpected lesson you learned from space travel?
Well, a lot of it had to do with this cognitive shift that I talked about. I would tell you, we are in a very precarious spot and you don't realize it until you're up there and you just see
we
meaning humanity. If you look at the whisper that the atmosphere is and you realize that 99.99999% of the universe is cold, hostile, and dead. And it is an absolute miracle that we're here. Absolute miracle. And we don't have a lot protecting us. We're in a very vulnerable state. And by the way, there is no other place, right? Yeah, we can build a space station. Yeah, we can go to the moon.
Elon wants to go to Mars.
You know, Mars is ambitious, but you know, you got to terraform it. Unless you want to live in a tunnel under the surface of Mars. I mean, radiation will get you pretty quickly. So,
you think we'll be living on the moon in 25 years?
Humans will. Yeah. I think within the next 10 years, you'll be able to sit on your porch and see lights on the moon.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. All right. If you could design a space mission, not anything having to do with profit or anything else, but like if you could just do something to shift human consciousness by designing a space project, what would you do?
I would go interstellar. So I would pick Andromeda, right? Alpha Centauri, which is the nearest star. And I would put, and this has been talked about, I'd send 10,000 little mini spacecraft that have a camera on it. Why 10,000? Because you want a couple to arrive. You can use solar sail technology, which basically puts a laser on these to accelerate them, to get them near the speed of light. We could probably get to Alpha Centauri in 20 years. Because you could go to, let's say, half the speed of light, something like that.
But what do you want to find or what do you want to discover?
You want to see if there's habitable planets there, right? Because Alpha Centauri is a star just like our star. And theoretically, there's planets orbiting that could be inhabitable. So I just think that'd be cool.
Wow. How long would it take?
It depends on how quickly you could accelerate these little, think of it as a microchip with a camera on it. Mm-hmm. Realistically, you can probably get them to about 0.6 the speed of light. Yeah, and Alpha Centauri, I think, is 3.2 light years away. So 15 years.
Wow. Something like that. That's super cool.
Yeah.
And you'd be then how long would it take for the results to get back?
3.2 years.
Okay.
Because of the speed of light.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've got something to watch in your retirement.
Yeah. Just to give you an idea how vast everything is, Voyager has been racing through the solar system for 46 years, right? That was launched in the 70s.
Wow.
It's the fastest object we've ever created. I think it's going about 38,000 miles an hour for 46 years. It is, it's not even one light day from Earth. It's 23 light hours away from Earth.
Oh.
So it's not even one light day. And we're talking about Alpha Centauri being 3.2 light years away.
Mm. Hard to fathom.
Yeah.
All right. Last question. You have built a life that sort of orbits, if you'll excuse the pun, around sort of this whole purpose with exploration. What's one question that you keep asking yourself about where you want to go?
You know, I wish we could have more time to focus on this. So focused, and you'll see a lot of overlap between space and longevity. And the main reason between those, the space and longevity communities, the overlap is because these big questions, like we were just talking about, you need more time, right? If you want to go to another solar system, it's going to take hundreds of years, right? And so I'm very fascinated with, and it's not for me, myself personally, it's can humanity figure out a way to hack our biology in such a way that we can actually do these more ambitious things. You know, Mars is hard, but like another solar system, things like that.
Well, these movies put people to sleep, you know, and all that kind of stuff.
Yep, that's a possibility. But so I just wonder about, you know, is there a way to fuse with, you know, artificial intelligence? I don't know. I mean, this is very much a science fiction genre in and of itself, but I spent a lot of time thinking about that, actually.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, and I suppose that helps you, you know, I don't know. Well, how would it help you thinking about these things in your day-to-day world?
Again, I go back to small ball, right? The world plays small ball. I think the bigger you can think, the bigger your ambition, and I use that word, you know, as a, not an individualistic thing, but as a humanitarian thing. I think, first of all, the more fun you're going to have in life. But secondly, I think it's going to lead you to work on things that really matter. And really, you know, we're all at a point, or should be at a point, where it's like, what does this all mean? Like, why are we doing what we're doing? Like, what's the purpose of this? And it can't be personal ambition. It can't be personal glory, right? That's all, those are traps. Those are dead ends. It's got to be, how am I impacting humanity? How am I impacting the future of civilization? And if you're not asking questions like that, you're not going to do much in your life. You're just not.
Wow. Good note to end on. Let's do that. I'm your host, Dave Tabor, and today on ProCo 360, you've been listening to my conversation with Dylan Taylor of Voyager Space. Dylan, what a fun conversation to have on ProCo 360.
Well, thank you, Dave. It was great being here. Great questions. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
It was fun. Listeners, glad you're here on ProCo 360, where we say live, work, love Colorado, because you and I and my guests can be successful anywhere and choose Colorado. You make the show successful by subscribing to the ProCo 360 podcast. Hey, if you haven't yet, it's a huge help if you submit a review in your app. Thanks again to show sponsors Via Technologies, Denver Ventures, and Colorado Biz Magazine. That's the show, Live, Work, Love, Colorado.